This is Talk at 10. It's your weekday interview program on KRTS Marfa Public Radio. I'm Tom Michael, and I'll be your host for this episode. We're pleased to be joined in the studio by Andrew Lanham and Carolyn Pfeiffer. The Reading is a stage presentation of a Nickel Fellowship-winning screenplay. It's being hosted by Ballroom Marfa. It's being presented this Saturday at the Crawley Theater in Marfa. That's at Abbott and El Paso Streets. At 3 o'clock matinee and at 8 o'clock. The winning script was The Jumper of Maine, written by Andrew Lanham. This is directed by John Davies, and it's produced by Carolyn Pfeiffer and Nancy Sanders. In the studio, we have Carolyn Pfeiffer and Andrew Lanham. Welcome.
Hello.
Thank you.
Carolyn, what is the Nichols Fellowship?
The Nichols Fellowship is the Nichols Fellowship is the most important screenwriting fellowship certainly in the United States. And it is presented by the Academy of Motion Pictures Arts and Sciences. It was an endowment left to the Academy by, what's his name?
Joe Nickel, I think.
No, it wasn't Joe Nickel. I'll get it right in a second. And they receive about 6,000 or in excess of 6,000 scripts a year. It's an annual grant. And out of which five winners are chosen. And each winner receives $30,000. And gets a wonderful trip to Los Angeles and is introduced to the film industry.
How long has this fellowship been around? And have there been examples of some screenplay winners that have gone on to be produced?
Many examples, and I'm going to get Andrew to help me with it because he's probably fresher. 25 years. This was their 25th anniversary. Nancy and I went up for the award party, the award dinner, which is one of the most fun things that the Academy does. It's not televised. It's very intimate, and it's great fun. And, Susanna Grant, who wrote...
Aaron Brockovich, and The Soloist. Finding Forrester was one of the more famous scripts that was an actual Nickel-winning script.
And that's a Gus Van Sant film?
Yep.
Right. It's a very revered thing. And when Ballroom wanted to start this program, and we were thinking of screenplays, the obvious place for us to go to was, and it was about helping emerging screenwriters, was to approach the Academy and ask if they would kindly allow us to select a Nickel winner.
Who was on the selection committee?
On the final selection committee, Robert Shapiro, who was former head of Warner Brothers Studios and former, I believe the title was international president of William Morris Agency, and then he's now a producer, an independent producer, and he is a member of the actual Nichols Committee, which consists of 10 people. He and Diane Ossana, who is a writer, and I think you may have interviewed her with Larry McMurtry. She's Larry McMurtry's writing partner. And Andrew Marlowe, who I just mentioned, who writes Castle at the moment and is showrunner for Castle.
Again, we're talking about The Reading. It's a staged presentation of this Nickel Fellowship winner at Ballroom Marfa. I think seats are still available for either the 3 o'clock matinee or the 8 o'clock performance. That's at the Crawley Theater this Saturday. You can call 729-3600, that's Ballroom Marfa's number, to find out more. The winning script, The Jumper of Maine. Andrew Lanham is our guest in the studio as well. And you said, Andrew, you wrote this script 2.5 years ago, and you began writing it, your latest draft this last year. You're currently a student at the MFA program at the University of Texas at Austin.
Yeah.
It's called The Jumper of Maine. It follows an ambulance driver named Oliver who has suffered from Tourette's his whole life. And there's a tragedy with his family early on. And it's about him coming to grips with that and also finding love in the form of an old childhood friend named Allison, Oliver and Allison. Tell us a little bit about this story and what drew you to the topic.
Well, I have Tourette's myself, and I grew up with it. I'm 27 now, but when I was younger, it was fairly severe growing up. When I hit around 22, 23, it went down a lot. When I got into graduate school, I thought I needed to write another script because I'd only written my first script that got me into school. And it kind of seemed like a natural place to go to. I tend to write fairly personal things, and I like to process the world and what I'm living in through my writing. And I don't think there's ever been a really accurate film about Tourette's, or the films that have been about Tourette's, they usually portray the person with Tourette's as a compulsive swearer or really, really extreme forms of the syndrome. And only 8% of people with Tourette's actually have anything with swearing or repeating words.
The female lead, Allison, Googles Tourette's at one point in the screenplay. I didn't. What are the other manifestations of that?
In order to be diagnosed with Tourette's, you have to have a physical tic and some sort of vocal tic. So you might shake your head a lot and make honking noises, or clear your throat a lot and blink a lot, and they have to change in around 3-month periods. If you had the most severe case of Tourette's, like humanly possible, then you would swear uncontrollably. And it's the only symptom of Tourette's that has its own name, and they call it echolalia. And it's actually the repetition of vowel sounds and consonants. But most people with Tourette's, they're kind of compelled to do socially awkward things, so swearing kind of comes naturally. But the majority of people who suffer from Tourette's or are dealing with Tourette's have some sort of combination of non-actual word symptoms.
I was in Odessa the other day, in Midland, Odessa, and there's a public radio program called Says Who, and they were talking about how they did a study on the fact when you hit a hammer to your thumb and you swear, it actually relieves the pain.
Mm-hmm.
So is there some connection there?
Yeah, I think that in general with Tourette's, it's kind of like your thoughts or your feelings are building up really, really rapidly and kind of overflowing, and then you just need the constant release, and you can't keep yourself from that constant release. And as you grow older with the Tourette's, and I think it's one of the reasons it tends to die down for people, you become more adept at controlling yourself and the stuff coming out.
Let's talk about the age thing then. I described a childhood habit that alarmed my teachers,
yeah.
And you said that these things pass through age stages as well.
Yeah. As I said, like most people with Tourette's, around 22, 23, it tends to go down. And at the same time, most people with Tourette's, like a lot of little kids will blink a lot or sniff a lot or have kind of twitches, and then they kind of tend to grow out of them. And if you end up being diagnosed with Tourette's, there's a good chance, like with me, that you hit middle school or you start puberty and it kind of explodes because of all the hormones and everything that's going on with your decision-making process. And then as that balances out, it tends to die down a lot.
Is it a medicable disease?
Sort of. There's no test to diagnose you with Tourette's. And when I was younger, there was little to no understanding of really how to medicate it. So they would tend to put kids on antipsychotics or really heavy narcoleptics, and which they did with me, and they were really detrimental to growing up and coping with things. And now they're kind of getting more knowledgeable about how to treat it, but there's no cure. There's no like specific golden remedy to get rid of it.
Let's talk about the screenplay. The Jumper of Maine features Oliver, who suffers from Tourette syndrome. He's in his mid to late 20s. He's an ambulance driver. After a childhood tragedy, he reconnects with a friend of his sister's. Her name is Allison. She's has a young girl, a child, and a failed marriage. And he reconnects with her. And there's something in the script and in the story. There's a common theme, and that would be that the affliction shows, and that is the honk. And I suppose, and Carolyn, you can jump in here too, the presentation of that in the stage reading or in the ultimate film matters quite a bit because other people have taken on this verbal tic as a punctuation point throughout the play.
I have not been to rehearsal yet. So I think, and I'm sure Andrew and John have discussed it, and we have, we're very, very pleased that we have an extremely talented young actor from Dallas playing the role of Oliver, and he is the person who does the honk in the strain.
And other characters will as well, either in sympathy or
exactly.
Kind of echoing. You know.
Yeah. Exactly. The daughter of the woman that he falls in love with, who is actually played by Camille Rutherford, who is the daughter of the Gallery Urbain folks, Rhee and Jason, I think. She loves this character, Oliver, and so she's a young girl of about 8, and she actually has diabetes. The screenplay deals with several ailments. Alzheimer's, diabetes, Tourette's, their characters, like in life, that, you know, that are coping with things. And so the fact that Oliver and his cohort Chad are paramedics takes us into this world in a very natural way, which is great. So they have been rehearsing in Dallas. They just arrived last night from Dallas to start working with the Marfa actors. So I can't tell you how they're doing the honk. Maybe you can, Andrew.
Well, this is radio. What would an example of a honk be?
Hey. Every time you say honk, I want to honk because of my Tourette's. But that's the noise that I like. Hey. And most people with Tourette's, or at least me, you kind of have a baseline, like your base. Like I have my set, like my go-to tics. Like things will change, but I'm kind of always, I've always had that noise, like hey. And it changes as I grow, but that one's been with me since I was a really little kid. That and sticking my tongue out.
And the balance for us in presenting a screenplay, or either a stage screenplay or the film, will be finding the measure that will work at a comfortable level for the public, where they'll feel empathy for this character, and it won't at the same time become something that's so uncomfortable for them that makes them nervous. So it's a fine balance to find, but we have a fine director, so we're very confident that he's going to do that.
You mentioned the sticking the tongue out, which is used comedically in the play as well, also momentarily as a point of attraction.
Yeah.
Between the two main characters. Again, it follows the story of Allison and Oliver and their relationship, as well as Oliver's relationship with his family. His parents and his sister. Oliver is an ambulance driver. He only feels at peace when the siren is going. That allows him to focus. Maybe you could talk about this, because this threads its way through the screenplay, Andrew.
Yeah, when I was diagnosed in middle school. When I was in high school, I did a lot of theater, and when I'd be on stage, my Tourette's would disappear. I think it had something to do with that my body and my mind were focused completely at the same time. Like if I read or watch a movie or work out, my Tourette's goes absolutely insane. But if everything's focused, it tends to narrow things down. And I think that happens to everyone, even if you don't have Tourette's. And then I saw a 2020 special once a few years ago about a surgeon with really severe Tourette's. And whenever he went into the operating room, it vanished.
Michael Jordan talks about the zone.
Yeah.
Of course, as a basketball player, he used to stick his tongue out when he would... make some of those monster plays. Andrew Lanham is our guest, along with Carolyn Pfeiffer. We're talking about The Reading. It's a staged presentation of a winning screenplay. Andrew is currently a student at the University of Texas at Austin. During last year's film festival, you won both the drama screenplay competition as well as another screenplay award. For this piece?
Yeah.
Okay, for this piece. So this has been staged before?
No. I had like a table reading last spring in the small workshop where I had rewritten two full drafts of it, but this will be the first fully staged reading of it.
So table reading, actors are just sitting around a table reading it without any rehearsal usually of any kind.
Right.
Tell us about some of the other performers, especially some of our local performers, Carolyn.
Well, we have Harry Hudson playing Oliver's father, and we have Felix... Benton playing young Oliver, and we have Camille is Williford is sort of bi-coastal. She lives in Dallas and goes to school there now, but her parents also are from Marfa. We have Susanna Lipsy, who plays the ghost of Grace. I won't try and explain that because it's part of the plot. We have our three lumberjacks who play multiple roles are Corey Van Dyke and Steve Holzer and James Rodwell. And we have Lily Wilson playing... there's just a very small scene with a swearing French woman. And then we have Sam Schonzeit playing the ex-husband of Allison, our romantic lead. I don't want to forget anybody. And the other actors are from Dallas, so it's about split. And I forgot Jenny Lynn Hamilton. Jenny Lynn is playing the role of Cheryl.
You're listening to Talk at 10 here on KRTS Marfa Public Radio. Again, the stage presentation will be Saturday, which is in 2 days, at 3 p.m. and at 8 p.m. You can find out more online at ballroommarfa.org. Again, producers Carolyn Pfeiffer and Nancy Sanders. Carolyn Pfeiffer has a long association with film production, and Andrew Lanham, an emerging artist here, and we're pleased to have him in Marfa. Well, there's something about film, about screenplays, that tries to speak to the universal, and there's a theme in here. One nature theme that's used a couple times as a pivotal thing is the idea of a wave, and the thing that a wave washes over you, and you have no control of the wave. It's just something that's in nature.
Yeah, I think that ties in with this idea that everyone's kind of dealing with something, which was really important to me, that the character learns that he's not really special just because he has to deal with Tourette's, because everyone has certain things that they have to deal with. And when we're dealing with these things or anything in life or tragedies in life, it can often feel like a wave is kind of like sweeping you over and you can't really control it, but we try to fight against it somehow anyway, when the goal is really to accept it.
And a further thought that comes out in the play is the idea that you're all alone in the world with your affliction. One of the characters said, "Do you have some kind of what is the line, Andrew?
I can't remember what the line is, but I remember the idea.
Do you have something magical inside you that no one else can see?
Yeah, like, do you think you're more special than the person to the left of you or to the right of you just because you're having a really rough time right now? I think when I was younger, you can feel very alone in whatever it is that you're having to deal with. I feel like that's a really natural thing. But it can be really liberating when you can move away from yourself and step out of your situation and realize that everyone's dealing with.
I would also like to say that I think it's really interesting that the King's Speech, which deals with King George's battling uncontrollable stammering.
One of the Academy Award nominated films.
The Academy Award winning film for Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actor,
and Best Screenplay.
The oldest screenwriter ever to receive an Academy Award for Original Screenplay, and he was 73. And I thought his acceptance speech was wonderful when he said, "My father always told me I would be a late bloomer." But I think it's interesting that, you know, how popular this film has been. It's really a small art house movie, and how popular it has been with a global audience dealing with someone's struggle with that kind of.
Well, help me with that, Carolyn. It seems that Hollywood, and maybe that includes a reflection on America itself, seems to be drawn to explosions, of course, but also people persevering against disabilities.
Hollywood responds to what basically does well in the marketplace. So it's greater than Hollywood. It's really what the audience responds to. And the obvious comparison is Rocky, which really was about people that overcome everything to achieve what seems to be the impossible. In the case of the King, I mean, the King seemingly had everything, but he could not stand up in front of his people and speak.
But in film, we understand man against nature, man against man, but man against himself is harder to visually realize.
Absolutely true.
Yeah, and it's in my workshops for this script in particular, there were a lot of people would say, like, you need to change this, you need to change this, because man against himself can often come across as self-pity. And they say that kind of stops a script dead. But I think it's a really universal thing that the things we struggle against, we at times can let define us. And I think when audiences are sitting in a theater, like in the King's Speech, and you're watching someone who comes to terms with himself and moves away from letting his affliction define him, I think that's a really inspiring thing. And people can get a lot of hope and inspiration from that.
Let's talk about the comic element. You and I off camera mentioned the TV show Pushing Daisies, because of the use of this click freeze, also the more experienced heroine, the unsure hero, and the fact that he's reconnecting with a childhood friend. But there's a lot of comic scenes in the way the two Allison and Oliver react based on the Tourette's. There's something about the man against himself. Where there, you almost will see the verbal aside, mm-hmm. which could be the slap to the face. I went on a date once, and I heard the woman whisper to herself, "I can't believe I said that." And it's almost like that verbal aside is made present, and it's a comic moment.
Yeah, I think that whatever you're dealing with, it's important to laugh at yourself. And I think that especially with something like Tourette's, where you have a character who, when he's getting upset, he's slapping himself or hitting himself, it's even more important to keep the humor intact within it, to make it enjoyable and to make it a little bit less draining to watch.
Diffuse it.
Yeah.
So when another character does that out of sympathy, it's a comic moment.
Yeah. And growing up, my best friend and in my relationships and my parents, like, we, once we got used to the Tourette's, we laughed at it a lot and used it for humor, because it's kind of, at some point it's like, what else are you going to do? You're having to deal with this, and it makes dealing with it easier.
It's like slapstick in a way, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
Andrew, how do you work as a writer, a morning writer, evening writer?
I'm a morning writer. I can't write past like 4 o'clock. My mind feels really cluttered. I tend to wake up at 6 and I start writing by 7. I write longhand during the day for a few hours, and then I type up at night.
Carolyn, is the film industry like the music industry, in which record companies don't promote bands anymore? Everyone has a band. Does it feel like everyone has a screenplay? Think of that line in, was it Barton Fink, where he said, throw a rock, Fink, you're going to hit a screenwriter?
Yeah. In any category of filmmaking, whether it be screenwriter, director, actor, so even technicians, if they achieve a certain degree of success, they start to build what's called their team, manager, agent, press agent, business manager, and so forth. There are very few people. People aren't under contract anymore, so the world has changed from the old studio system. Andrew, just diverting for a second, Andrew, because of the Nickel Fellowship, because of the quality of his screenplay, now has a top agency representing him, a top management firm representing him, and a very successful Hollywood producer is what's called attached to the project, and is now trying to set up The Jumper of Maine as a movie.
But we also know that, and you know, correct me if I'm wrong, sometimes Hollywood moves at glacial places. Things will get attached, great names will be on things, and then they'll sit on the shelf.
That's absolutely right.
It's kind of like that wave in Andrew's screenplay. It's out of our hands.
Yeah.
It is out of our hands, and I think if we completely understood how to make it work, we'd all be working all the time. There's so many elements involved, because it's such a collective decision-making process, and the truth is that the people at the absolute top who really do greenlight a picture, you almost never get to. And so you're working through all these layers of lieutenants, if you will.
And those people at the top are thinking about other things. They're corporate executives looking numbers.
That's right. But you just persevere, and the one thing about being in this business for a long time is you kind of get to know it, even though it's ever-shifting. You know, you understand the language of the business, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. I suppose the same applies to any real activity.
Andrew, are you optimistic about the business? Is it thrown its challenges in your face? How do you feel?
I'm optimistic. Right now I feel incredibly lucky, because I'm a relatively young screenwriter, and I got my foot through the door a lot faster than a lot of my peers in my age. So far, over this past year, it's just been good things happening over and over. So I'm optimistic, but at the same time, the head of my department told me you're only ever as good as your next script. So I think I'm lucky that I just want to be a writer and I just want to write. So as long as I get up every morning and keep writing, I'm kind of always happy. It'll be great if something happens with it, but at the same time, even if nothing happens with Jumper of Maine, I'm still writing my new script, and I feel good about that, and I'm moving forward.
And the grant money has given him the comfort of, because there was grant money attached to the other two awards from the Austin Film Festival, for him to take the next year once he graduates this spring, and I believe he's planning to go to New York rather than Hollywood, and really, really work as a writer and not have to worry about going out and waiting tables or doing some other profession to support his writing talent.
Our guest on Talk at 10 today, Andrew Lanham. He is the screenwriter for The Jumper of Maine. There'll be a staged presentation of this. It's called The Reading. It'll be hosted by Ballroom Marfa at the Crawley Theater. We're also joined by esteemed producer Carolyn Pfeiffer, who along with Nancy Sanders helped produce this. Directed by John Davies, and on the selection committee includes Andrew Marlowe, Diana Osana, and Robert Shapiro, who will be our guest tomorrow on Talk at 10. Carolyn, a moment ago, said that film, unlike other disciplines, is extremely collaborative. Have you found that you've had to make compromises to what perhaps you consider a personal story because readers have said it doesn't make sense, Andrew?
So far, I haven't, but there's a good chance that I will have to in the future. But at the same time, I feel like a screenplay is really more of a blueprint than anything else, and you're hoping that a large number of different people will take a different inspiration from what I've created and turn it into something else. So if I get notes from people or if things need to change in order to have the vision be more fully realized and actually come to fruition, like to actually be made into a film, I don't really view that as a compromise. I've been told by one professor that I'm the only screenwriter he knows who smiles through notes, because with any screenplay, you'll get notes and most people will get really, really upset. But I kind of love it when I think it's perfect and it falls apart because of the notes, and then I have to put it back together. And putting it back together is my favorite part of the process. So it never really feels like a compromise. It just feels like a step toward allowing it to become what I originally felt in my heart before I started writing.
So you've let the ego go with the script a bit.
Yeah, I think you have to as a screenwriter. If you're a playwright, they give you a lot of respect, but screenwriters famously don't get that. So you can't really have an ego or hold on to things.
You have no idea. I know major producers that will have in the past assigned three separate writers to do exactly the same thing, with none of them know that other writers were writing exactly the same thing, to then choose what he would consider to be the best. One, I did want to really applaud and thank Ballroom Marfa for doing this, because one of the decisions, because of Nancy Saunders and Fairfax Dorn and Virginia Liberman, was that the screenwriter is a very unrecognized component of the filmmaking process. They usually aren't invited to be on set. I mean, there are very, very few screenwriters that achieve real, you know, household recognition. Usually you have no idea who the screenwriters are unless you are actually living and working in the film industry. But because Ballroom was about emerging artists, they thought, let's choose the writer who is not so celebrated and celebrate the writer as part of their film program. Hence, this was born.
By the way, each performance will be followed by a Q&A moderated by Robert Shapiro. That'll be at 3 p.m. again and at 8 p.m., including Dallas actors as well as local actors. We've been talking to Andrew Lanham and Carolyn Pfeiffer. And again, it's a story of Oliver and Allison, Oliver's partner in the ambulance, Chad, his parents, Roger and Meredith, Allison's ex-husband, Douglas, the daughter, Marley, Oliver's sister, Grace, and, you know, Oliver and Allison and their growing love affair. But let's go back to the title, The Jumper of Maine. Andrew, you're from Maine. Where?
Bangor.
Where's that?
It's kind of in the middle.
Okay. And it's near the water, right?
Yeah, it's like an hour from
the water.
Everything's near the water and everything's kind of in the middle.
We have some Mainers in town every winter here as well, and I have some family up there we were talking about. But why The Jumper of Maine?
Well, the first recorded, there was this a man named George Beard, and in the late 1800s, he was vacationing in Maine, and he heard about a group of brothers from France who had immigrated over, and they were lumberjacks, and they were famous that because whenever they were chopping down trees, when their axes would hit the trees, they would leap into the air. So he went and watched these brothers, and he wrote a paper on it called The Jumping Frenchmen of Maine.
But wouldn't that just be a way to swing a bat or a golf club? Or
you would think. And in fact, it might have been. It wasn't until a few years later that Dr. Tourette in France, he had a female patient who swore uncontrollably, and his assistant was writing a paper on this woman, and he came across in his research the paper on the jumping Frenchman, and they combined the two to create the term Tourette's.
Was jumping ever part of your affliction?
It wasn't, no.
You still haven't explained why at night sometimes.
Yeah, why at night you jump up and down. Yeah, well, I don't have a good answer.
Well, my wife doesn't even know that. She's hearing it now for the first time. I'll face east and jump up and down three times if I'm thinking about a certain thing.
I think we just all do weird things. I think maybe that's the whole point of life.
We better close. The Jumper of Maine, Andrew Lanham, and Carolyn Pfeiffer joining us for the reading. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tom.